Your alternative talk radio contact, The Planet, KGRARadio.com.
Infinite complacence. People went to and fro the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Welcome to another episode of Into the Fray. First, a big hello and a thank you to my newest patrons. Michael, Christopher, Ian and Brennan of the Ghost Story Guys, Randy, Adrian, Roland, Craig, Brian, David, James Salcido of Salcido Paranormal, Dodie, Michael, Brittany, Alan, John, Tony, Liz, Jen, Cassandra, Ron, Bren, Harold, and last but not least, James. Welcome aboard, guys. So, if you love the show, and you'd like to help support it, plus get more content for yourself, head to patreon.com, search Into the Fray, where you'll find four different pledge levels to choose from. These range from the early release of the Thursday episode, to live video chats, stickers, signed books, bonus episodes, our own Discord room, and, to me, one of the best features of Patreon besides the easy-to-use app, your own private RSS feed, so that all your bonus audio content can be enjoyed right through your podcatcher. So again, head to patreon.com and search Into the Fray. Besides me asking you to head to Amazon to leave your review of both Beyond the Fray Bigfoot and Paramalgamation, I am still searching for more Bigfoot encounters for the second Beyond the Fray Bigfoot book. If you have been in touch, though, in the past, reach back out to me. Sometimes things do get lost in the fray. So, email me at shannon@intothefrayradio.com. As always, thanks for listening. Let's go to the swamp with Lyle. For our first visit, Lyle, we had you on episode 75, and that was for Beyond Boggy Creek. But this time around, we are heading to the swamp. And it is for your new released Sinister Swamps, Monsters, and Mysteries from the Mire. So welcome back, Lyle.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So in this book, and it's fitting that you would head back to the swamps again, you know, beyond Boggy Creek. And Boggy Creek, specifically the area, is very much attached to you, as are you to it. So this one, you go all over the U.S., and, you know, as far as the actual locations themselves and the logistics of maybe getting into them can be a little tricky, and or just you're just legally not allowed to go into them. So how many of these locations were you actually able to visit while researching?
I probably went to about half the swamps that I mentioned in the book or cover in the book. And, you know, the ones that I cover in detail, you know, the majority of those I went to, especially the ones in the southeast. I mean, being from Texas, so they're a little easier to get to. But, you know, there's a lot of swamps mentioned in the book, and it does have a wide range of coverage. So obviously I wasn't able to just go to every single one, but hopefully, you know, enough to where I can continue to bring that sort of first person perspective to, you know, when I describe the area or, you know, give some insights into that particular swamp.
And was there anything surprising you found out while you were either out actually, you know, researching an area in person or while you were researching just online or in other tomes for this book?
I think the most surprising thing to me was just in general doing the research was that how much different phenomenon there were reported in almost every swamp. I mean, the ones that I cover certainly had to fit a certain criteria, and that would be, you know, that they had enough phenomenon of some sort to warrant, you know, an entire chapter or a section of a chapter. But, you know, the once you start kind of looking into it, you know, I may have heard of a swamp in relation to maybe some Bigfoot sightings or, you know, ghostly phenomenon or a spook light. But then when you started really delving into it, there would just be every sort of paranormal thing going on, or, you know, a host of weird legends that just were oozing out of these swamps. So most of the time I didn't have a problem, you know, gathering up enough to sort of present this idea that these, you know, swamps locations were just a kind of a hub of paranormal activity.
And we've heard many a times people say that water can be a conduit for paranormal activity. So do you think that's an easy go-to explanation for why some of these, or actually most of these, if not all of these locations, even if they're not in your book, might be a magnet for this kind of activity?
Yeah, I think that's probably one aspect of it. And certainly in terms of, you know, cryptids or mysterious creatures, you know, because, you know, that's a place where there's plenty of water and food and, you know, things that they would need to survive. So certainly in that aspect. And then, you know, just from the general aspect of the water and it being their bottomlands, they're not easy to develop. You know, they've kind of remained in their primitive state, you know, all this time. I mean, you know, obviously some of the swamps have been encroached upon and tried to develop it, but, you know, you can't put a housing project in the middle of the Everglades, you know, and so forth. So a lot of these places just remain in their primordial state and perhaps, you know, preserve whatever strangeness that has always been there, it still remains in these areas.
Have you ever had a close encounter with something that was either poisonous or maybe you wanted to take, you know, an ankle and foot off, like an alligator or something like that?
Yeah, a couple of times. Obviously, if you're going to tromp the swamps, you know, you're going to run across, you know, even if you don't see a Bigfoot, you will see other things. And there was, you know, I've seen obviously water moccasins or cottonmouths, and a few times to where they were literally kind of canoed back into this little slough, myself and my late friend Tom Shirley. And, you know, I saw a water moccasin kind of scurrying around on the edge of the bank. And then I look up and these things were literally hanging from the trees and they looked pissed off. I mean, like, what are you, you know, like you have the audacity to come into our area. That was kind of spooky because you never really see, you know, there's snakes out there, but you don't often see them because, you know, they blend in and they're not trying to be after you. But this was kind of scary. And then on another occasion, I was walking next to a bayou that kind of, the channel kind of curved back and forth in a snake-like fashion. And there's some really tall grass and I was walking up towards that. And I just hear this commotion and I see this big tail flip up and go higher than the high grass and then a splash in the water. And then I just went through that little section of grass and you could see the fresh prints of an alligator. Mm. Had he not made his presence known, I would have just nearly walked right up on him because I didn't realize I was so close to the actual water when I was walking at that point. So yeah, that was a little nerve wracking.
We need a cryptid hunter insurance out there. Someone needs to start that up, you know? That the hazards of the mysteries and the cryptid hunting is nearly endless. And I know that snakes climb trees, but there's just something just really wrong about that to me. So let's jump in here to this book. And if we could, I would love to start in one of the places that I think has the coolest name, and that is the Great Dismal Swamp. Tell us a little bit about that area, and then maybe, you know, pick one of your favorite stories from that chapter to tell us.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the Great Dismal, you know, just the name itself, you know, conveys so much about the spooky swamp vibe that so many of these swamps have. And, you know, the Great Dismal is located in parts of North Carolina and Virginia, and is one of the ones further north that I was able to cover. And, you know, it is in many ways like it sounds. You know, it's vast, even today, a vast expanse of, you know, bogs and, you know, cypress trees and Spanish moss hanging down the proverbial swamp. And, you know, within that one, I found that there was a great, you know, huge variety of tales, whether they were, you know, old legends, ghosts and witches and things, to more modern accounts of what we would consider Bigfoot-like creatures, you know, devil dogs, all sorts of a menagerie of creepy creatures, you know, hidden in the backwaters there. And so Dismal is definitely one of the prime spots and one of the most notorious of U.S. swamps. One thing I thought was cool about Great Dismal Swamp was tales of witches. You know, not all the swamps had witches included, and I thought that was something that just sort of in the description, when you read something online, they always mention it. You know, tales of ghosts, of course, creatures, and also witches and cannibal witches and all this stuff. So I thought, you know, those are cool. And, you know, I found that there were several, you know, legends or tales that had come out of there. And one of those was a story of a couple who had moved back into an island within the Great Dismal Swamp and were making their living, scratching it out of the bog with whatever they were doing, livestock or farming or what have you. But the husband ended up dying suddenly, and presumably this was natural causes, but the folks who saw this man said that he had this sort of shocked, terrified look on his face in death. And this, you know, his widow just sort of went off the rails and became reclusive. And over time, you know, she was once beautiful, and then she became wrinkled and shriveled, and her teeth blackened, you know, and her hair turned gray, and, you know, just became, you know, withdrawn to herself. And the locals, you know, felt sorry for her. And then they started experiencing some problems, like their livestock began to die. And then, you know, suddenly some of the other residents began to die. And in some cases, they said they had that kind of scary fear look like her husband had had. So, of course, this sort of brought up, you know, some accusations that perhaps she had, you know, turned into a witch or was practicing witchcraft or something like that. And then one woman was in the throes of death in her room, and several people were present, and they saw, you know, strange shadows and things appearing on the walls and ceiling just as she was dying. And the moment she died, they saw this cat-like creature, this black-skinned thing lurking just outside the door. And several men actually ran outside and tried to pursue this thing, and it took off through the swamp and ended up running to this widow's old cottage out there. And they said they found her in front of a fire chanting in a strange tongue. And so, of course, now that, you know, she was guilty of witchcraft, and they put her on trial and proceeded to try to burn her at the stake, and she brought forth some sort of a strange magical orb of some sort and was able to escape the fire and was never to be seen again. But, you know, I thought those tales were cool and not only swampy, but kind of added that whole occult witchcraft feel to some of the stories.
That's what's cool about the book. You've got the cryptids in there, which of course everyone is expecting from you, and you also provide that. But there's the creepy tales, there's missing people. And of course, guys, the book is available now, so you can go pick up your own copy. Yeah, those poor bog witches, Lyle, they get a bad rap, and it's pretty unfair. I mean, can't you just do sacrifices in the privacy of your own home without people coming and trying to burn you at the stake? It's really messed up.
Exactly. I mean, the woman was way back in the swamp. How much more, you know, private can you possibly get? And she was still persecuted. So,
well, yeah, we're going to stay in the Great Dismal for this next one. And this one I really enjoyed, and that is The Vanishing Graveyard.
Yeah, definitely. That was one that was mentioned to me several times when I was looking into this. And, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds cool. Fortunately, I was able to run down some tales of this supposed graveyard that would appear and disappear. You know, normally, I mean, you kind of associate that kind of thing with ghosts and specters of that nature. But this was, you know, in this case, it was an actual graveyard. And one of the oldest stories dates back to the 1930s with a man named John Sweet, who was working a job digging one of the swamp canals that they were constructing there in Virginia. And one afternoon he was walking back to wherever he was living from the at a camp, and he came across this sort of open area, and he noticed there was a group of gravestones. You know, they were old and weathered and seemed like they had been there for quite some time. And he thought, wow, this is, you know, this is interesting. Kind of seems like a historical site, you know, a family who lived there long ago. And so, you know, he noted the location and then went off back home. And on the next day off, he decided to bring his wife down there and show her. And when he came there, the graves were gone. And he was quite certain that he knew the spot. I mean, he'd walked by this area many times going to work. He, for the life of him, could not find, you know, the grave markers, you know, as if it was an illusion or a ghostly vision unto itself. And then over the years, others reported this vanishing graveyard phenomenon, where they would come across graves in the middle of the swamp that seemed to disappear. And in some instances, you know, they would do like John did. They would have seen them and try to return to them later, and they were gone. And in one instance, though, somebody said that they were looking at them and then turned away for a moment and looked back, and they were literally gone. So, you know, it was just a really strange story. And obviously these are kind of more things that are rooted in legend and folklore, but nonetheless, stories that are attached to that swamp that show you that, you know, this phenomenon has been going on for a long time, and anywhere there's kind of this swampy location, there's always these strange tales.
I think that would be pretty cool to see, to be honest with you. Not every story in the book was on the sure, I would like that list, but yeah, some of them are on the big bag of note, but this one would be pretty cool to experience, I think. So on the next tour, we are going to go to a place that I actually enjoy trying to say this name whenever I possibly can. And this is in Georgia, and it is the Okefenokee Swamp. So tell us a little bit about this area, and then we're going to talk about something I love, which is lost flights. And this Flight 19, which is called the Lost Squadron, is here in the Okefenokee.
Yeah, the Okefenokee is a huge swamp area. It's located in southern Georgia and extends all the way almost into Florida. And it's one I've been to and explored in person. I was there several years ago with my research partner, Cindy Lee, and we did some guided boat tours, but we also took our own canoe and kind of paddled back into the backwaters. And you know, the thing about Okefenokee is it's one of those, it's just incredibly huge. That's what I noticed about it, just even trying to drive around it, you know, to go into certain areas. Just a huge swamp, and it has a long history, of course, of all sorts of tales, including, you know, some of the earliest southern Bigfoot accounts and things like that. And one of the things is that there were not only rumors of planes having crashed there and never been found, but there were instances where planes had crashed into that swamp and were never located. So, I mean, it's literally that big. And, you know, that kind of was something I was thinking about as Cindy and I were just paddling, you know, through these areas. It's like, wow, you know, what if we just paddled right over a lost plane? We would never know it, because, you know, the waters are dark and briny, and You know, it's shadowy back in these swamps. And if something sunk into the marsh grass and waters and was covered up, you know, unless you had a metal detector or you were in the right place, you'd never find it. The in keeping with that, one of the most famous of these lost plane stories is the Flight 19, which is often associated with the Bermuda Triangle. And this was a group of five Navy torpedo bombers on a training mission out of Florida that literally went missing on December 5th, 1945. And the crew consisted of 14 men, and they were doing a Navy training course and had some navigational difficulties and had trouble contacting, you know, back to the base, and eventually just sort of communication got cut off and they were never seen again. And of course, those things inspire all sorts of theories and conjecture and research into trying to locate the planes. But even in modern times, no one has ever really proven or located those planes. And one of the theories that has been proposed was that they actually had turned inland. And as the evening began to grow dark, they got out over one of these swamps, both either the Everglades or Okefenokee, and had to ditch in the swamp and, you know, were just sucked in by the mire. And so this particular theory that it crashed into Okefenokee was proposed by Gian Quasar, who is sort of the authority on the Bermuda Triangle, or written books along those lines. And in one of his books, he tracked some communication from a naval carrier ship that reported seeing 4 to 6 aircraft coming in inland at Florida and going in the direction of what would be presumably Okefenokee Swamp, which later the Air Transport Command had also picked up 5 aircrafts flying near the swamp. And all searches to find any recorded scheduled flights in that area were fruitless. They never could, you know, find any explanation why there was 5 aircraft flying in that area. And then, of course, if that had been the point where they ran out of fuel or whatever and couldn't turn around to get to the landing base, they could have ditched in Okefenokee. It was literally so big that they could have been swallowed up. And even if the 14 crew members survived, you got to think about, you know, now they got to get out of there. They could be injured and things like that. Now you got to deal with snakes and panthers and no medical aid to try to find your way out of this swamp. And in 1945, of course, they, you know, would not have a GPS or anything else, you know, maybe not even a handheld compass to try to navigate out of there. So that was really an interesting theory, that one of these swamps could, you know, not only hide unknown creatures and ghostly figures, but literally, you know, hide one of the most famous of you know, air mysteries ever.
Lyle, is the Okefenokee still as big today as it was, you know, back when it was first found?
Well, it's not quite as big today. I mean, it's still big in terms of, you know, land area that's undeveloped, but certainly all of these swamps have been encroached on. So it's lost some of its acreage to development. And I mean, and some of that can be homes and things that are built in there. And all the swamps have had in habitation, you know, I mean, even Native Americans would use these, you know, places to set up villages and things because it was, you know, was protected somewhat, and they had, you know, access to food and water that they needed. But in terms of just general, you know, plowing them down, Okefenokee has remained fairly, you know, large.
Now, this next one, I couldn't let you off the hook without telling a ghost ship story. And for this one, we are going to head to the Everglades, which everyone is pretty familiar with. A lot of times, just because of the fact that you and I both, we talk about Bigfoot so much, of course, called the skunk ape down there. But this time for the Everglades, we're going to talk about a very ghostly ship and the really pretty terrible happenings that may have been the concoction for coming up with such an entity.
Right. Yeah. The Everglades is another place that just had a wide range of strange phenomenon. And one of my favorite ones is this tale of a ghostly pirate ship that's said to navigate, the twisted channels back in there on the coastal parts of the Everglades. And this was a story that originated back in the 1800s and was often told by some of the sailors who frequented the Florida coast. And according to the story, there was a band of fearsome pirates who was sailing in the area, and they came upon a merchant ship, and they decided to chase down the ship. And in this case, the merchant was onto them and provided a pretty good chase. They had a difficult time catching them. But finally, after, hours of pursuit, the pirates finally caught up to the merchant ship and boarded it. The captain pirate by this time was angry and furious, so he retaliated and forced the merchant crew to walk the plank one by one while the skipper's wife watched. She was apparently on board of this merchant ship, and, of course, she was horrified and traumatized, and she, at that point, allegedly, pleaded to God or placed some sort of curse on the pirates to damn them for eternity. And at the end of this, the pirates, plundered the ship and left, and a huge wave suddenly came up out of nowhere and forced them to sail into the labyrinth of swamp channels that's located there on the coastal Everglades. And those swamp channels are just a maze of mangroves and sawgrass and, areas where there's cypress trees rising up. And the pirates became trapped in here and couldn't navigate their way out, and eventually perished because they couldn't just get off and abandon the ship. They were just succumbed to the swampy waters. And for years since, allegedly, people have reported seeing this hazy form of a ghostly ship as it navigates in those channels of the mangroves and sawgrass. And that is the pirate ship of the Everglades.
Yeah, love stories of the pirate ships. I can never get enough of those kinds of tales. But, I mean, to be honest, some of the brutality that you do hear in some of these stories wouldn't want to be part and parcel of a story like that. So I can't blame the lady for, if she could lay a curse on people, it may as well be those guys, because they sounded like real jerks.
I think they deserved it.
Yeah, I think so. Now, this next one, this would be on my no thanks list, I think, after reading a certain detail of what this thing did, or person, entity, whatever word we want to use. But this one is the Everglades Ghost Boy. And I don't think I've ever, I mean, I have heard of other things in the water, but something about this story, I was like, no thanks. I don't know if I'd want to experience that. So yeah, the Everglades Ghost Boy is next.
Yeah, this is a rather spooky one. And the Everglades being as vast and large and spooky in some places as it is, this is something I also would not want to encounter. And as the story goes, a young man and his family was canoeing back there in 2008, and they had left from the Everglades National Park onto two canoes, and they were paddling in the waters there in the channels, and the boy noticed something moving below the surface. And when he looked down, he saw what he described as a human figure swimming alongside his canoe. And the water at that area is pretty shallow, but the figure just moved very fluently, like it had all the room in the world. And there's sand and mangrove trees and everything else, but it seemed to just be able to move freely. He described this strange swimmer as being a young boy, perhaps 13 or 14 years old. It had beautiful blonde hair that moved in the water. And eventually it kind of turned and looked up at the witness in the canoe, and he noticed that this thing had dark red eyes with black circles around them. And at that point, he sensed something of a feeling of sadness, cruelty, but also evil. And of course, you know, it just kind of frightened the young boy as he watched this thing in the water, and it swam off. And his family looked at him and said, "What's the matter?" And he just didn't want to say what it was. He just said nothing. You know, there's nothing the matter. And he kind of just, you know, went on. Well, later on, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, he looked up to the trees standing on the edge of the bank, and he saw this boy. And this time the ghostly boy was standing up on the edge, peering around a tree, and he had the red eyes, and his face looked angry. And before, you know, the witness could say anything this time, suddenly a strange wind picked up and sort of rocked the canoes. And his cousin was standing up filming the scenery, and she fell off into the water. And so the family scrambled and managed to pull her back up on the boat. And, you know, so that was a kind of a strange incident. And when the witness looked back, this ghostly boy was gone. So they went ahead and canoed the rest of the time, and, you know, the boy kept looking for this ghost, but never saw it again. And when they eventually arrived back at the canoe rental place where they had gotten the canoes, the witness's cousin began to complain of a sore back. Her back was aching or something. And her mother lifted up her shirt and was surprised to find that her back was purple and bruised, as though she had been hit or something. And, you know, she had fallen into the water, but she had not really hit anything. So, you know, that was another really strange incident. And of course, the witness who had seen the ghostly boy, you know, thought, man, this certainly has something to do with that sighting. But again, he just didn't want to say anything about it. He had never mentioned anything before and just kept it to himself. Well, as the story goes, a few years later, he had just obsessed and thought about this for so long that he decided to return to that boat rental place and, you know, kind of ask some of those guys if they had ever heard other people report anything like that. And one of the workers heard the story, and he said, well, in fact, this doesn't sound surprising. He said several years ago, there was a boy playing with his friends in that general spot where they had been canoeing, and the friends had placed a bet to see who could go underwater the longest and hold their breath, or go underwater and hold their breath the longest. And this young boy was from a poor family, and he really wanted to win because there was some sort of monetary prize. And he went down there and held his breath and never came back up. He drowned right there. And so, you know, this was something that was known to the people who worked around that area. And at that point, obviously, the young witness who had seen that ghostly boy, you know, definitely knew that whatever he had seen was probably, you know, the spirit of this poor kid who had drowned there years ago.
Well, I like that it's a more recent story. And the fact that there was the corroboration that, you know, he had this experience, they saw this thing, and then it wasn't actually till years later, when he couldn't get it out of his head, that he did find out that there was that story. So it wasn't the story was placed there first, and then he had the experience. So I really like that one. Sad story, of course, about a child drowning. I mean, who knows why it would then create such a, basically, a monster of some sort, so with red eyes and all of that. But yeah, that was still on the nope list. No thanks. No. I think I'd be a little ruined after that one. So this last area that we are going to go to is, you've actually dubbed this area the Cato Triangle, which is I mean, we've got triangles everywhere, so I think it's perfect that you coined this area that. So what are the points that make up the Cato Triangle, and how big is the Cato Triangle?
Yeah, that was something I noticed during the research, you know, and of course, you know, we've got the Bridgewater Triangle, the Bermuda Triangle. I thought, man, I need my own triangle here, and I need something that, you know, encompasses some of this, the southern lore that I have closer to home. And the Cato Triangle is an area that I defined as a place where there has been strange sightings, mostly confined to strange Bigfoot-like creatures. And the Cato Triangle would extend from, in this case, Mercer Bayou, which is like Boggy Creek in Falk, Arkansas, down to the area of Cato Lake in East Texas, near Jefferson, Texas, and then over to a place called Bayou Bodcow in northern Louisiana. And I keep, over the years, obviously, I live pretty close to that area, and I've gotten so many reports of Bigfoot creatures coming out of there, from the Cato creature to the Falk monster and things like that, that I just began to see this, you know, area that just had an overwhelming amount of reports and phenomenon going back to, you know, as far back as, you know, recorded papers, you know, would define these things. And it's an area that encompasses three states, and I'm not sure what the entire square mile footage of that would be, but it's probably a couple hours drive to each point, you know, into itself. So it's a pretty big area. And the reason I define that as the Cato Triangle is because not only is there some of the best Bigfoot stories coming out of there, but it's also an area that's inspired some of the most famous Bigfoot movies ever to be filmed. And of course, in the case of Boggy Creek, obviously there's the legend of Boggy Creek, which was based on sightings of, you know, a southern Sasquatch-like creature in and around Falk, Arkansas, a very small town. And then down in Cato Lake, back in 1976, there's a Bigfoot film called Creature from Black Lake. And that was filmed mostly in Cato Lake and Oil City, which is just over in Louisiana. And then the inspiration for the movie Creature from Black Lake was drawn from tales of a creature in this area called Bayou Bodcow, which is in northern Louisiana. And so it was this strange intersection of true life reports meets legendary Bigfoot film, all within this triangular area. So I thought that was significant, you know, as far as southern Bigfoot history. And again, those are places where I have been to all of those numerous times and have, you know, gotten some of what I consider the best, most credible reports that have come out of those areas.
Well, and I apologize. I wouldn't have an Into the Fray episode if I didn't mispronounce something. So I've been recently listening to Howard Stern talk about the O.J. Simpson trial. So then I naturally just called it Cato. So there you go. But it's Cato. Sorry, everybody. So for one of our last stories that Lyle's going to share with us, I had to go Bigfoot on this one. So that is a Charles Fasson story in the Cato Triangle.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the book is filled with great Bigfoot accounts, as people would expect from me, interwoven with all this other phenomenon. And I included this one I had taken from a man named Charles Faison several years ago. And this occurred in Cato Lake itself. And Cato Lake is people kind of associate swamps with Louisiana, of course. I mean, you think it's the swamp state, but Cato Lake extends into East Texas. And what most people don't realize is there is swampy areas of Texas. I mean, Texas is huge, so it's got just a little bit of everything. But Cato Lake, where it comes into Texas, is a very quintessential looking swamp. I mean, it has got the cypress trees, the Spanish moss hanging down, plenty of sloughs and backwoods that make up this area. And I befriended a girl several years ago and had posted some things about Caddo Lake. You know, I'd taken some pictures or whatever. And she said, you know, many years ago, my father saw something down there. You know, I think it was like a Bigfoot. I was like, really? And, you know, this is a guy who never really told his story. He wasn't broadcasting it anywhere. So I said, can I interview your dad? And so I proceeded to call up Charles Faison, and he told me that back in the summer of 1969, he and his brother were exploring back in Caddo Lake. And this is something they did often. They would spend their weekends at their grandfather's house, and, you know, they would just take off in a canoe and just hunt and fish and camp and even sleep back there in the swamp for the weekend. That's just what kids did back then. And one night they had been fishing and caught a bunch of fish, and they decided to camp in this little treehouse that they had built back in the swamp. And it's in a area known as Devil's Elbow, if that isn't appropriate.
Absolutely.
And so they cleaned the fish, and, you know, they had a good meal. And afterwards, you know, got up into their little treehouse and were sleeping. And within the night, Charles said they were wakened by noises, you know, sometime after midnight. And, you know, figuring it was raccoons or whatever, probably out there messing around with the leftovers from their meal. No kid can hear noise without looking. That's just what you do. You know, I mean, when I was hunting, I remember anything that moved, I got to go look at it. So he decided to peer out through the boards there in the treehouse. But in this case, what he saw was rather shocking. He said, when he looked out, they saw this tall human-like figure standing there, messing around with those leftovers that they had from dinner. And when he looked out, the thing stood up and looked right up at the treehouse. And he described this thing as being tall, covered in hair. It was perhaps, you know, at least 6 feet tall, probably seven. And, you know, it was definitely not a bear. It stood upright on 2 feet, long arms, you know, kind of ape-like looking. And he said, you know, he was just frozen, and he was trying to wake up his brother to have a look. And his brother kind of, you know, drowsy kind of wakes up. And as they watched this thing, it stared at him for a few moments, and then it turned and it just darted off into the trees and disappeared into the swamp. And of course, you know, just this was kind of, you know, something they couldn't quite get their heads around, because back in that, in 1969, they had never heard of Bigfoot. You know, Charles said, you know, I wasn't even aware of Bigfoot at the time. So he wasn't quite sure what he was looking at. It wasn't a man. It wasn't a bear, just some sort of monstrous thing standing there. And of course, they spent the rest of the night pretty much wide awake, dreading, thinking, is this thing going to come back, or what exactly was it? But it never returned. And in the morning, they got down out of the treehouse and investigated that area and found evidence where it could, you know, see where it darted off into the woods. There were broken saplings and limbs, and they found these huge footprints. He said they looked man-like. They definitely had five toes. You know, he didn't have a ruler or anything, but, you know, said they were probably, they could be at least 16 inches long by his estimation today. And he said it had a really large big toe, which was a detail I thought was interesting, because there have been some Bigfoot casts that show this sort of disproportionately large big toe. Now, this is a guy that doesn't know anything about Bigfoot. He's just describing what he had seen. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And anyway, so this was a very credible report, and a person that I felt was, these are my favorite kind of witnesses, you know, somebody who isn't, he wasn't out looking for Bigfoot. He wasn't, you know, Bigfoot not on his mind. And in fact, didn't even know what Bigfoot was. to have seen something like this and had kind of never really told anybody except for some people in his family, you know, what do you do with this? You just sort of tell people, and you generally people either dismiss it as a bear or laugh it off. But very, very credible report, and certainly in an area in Caddo Lake where I've investigated so much that there is plenty of stories. I mean, there was an outbreak of sightings 4 years prior to Charles Faison's in that area that, you know, people had reported seeing this upright, hairy thing actually chased a kid down a country road there. So, you know, just a great area for swampy Bigfoot.
And it's not like we don't like to hear the stories where people may have ongoing Bigfoot activity, especially around a home or something. But sometimes I truly love the stories that it was just, you know, one incident, and it may or may not have changed their life, or it stuck with them the rest of their life like it did with Charles. But I also love that one too, so I had to have you cover that one. And I mean, come on, the Devil's Elbow. Who doesn't love a name like that? I mean, at least it's better than some other areas of the body it could have been named after on the old devil. You know, it's the elbow, so. Other areas may garner some worse names, but elbow, not so bad. Well, Lyle, before I let you go, is there another encounter story that you wish I would have asked you about that you'd like to talk about?
Certainly. I mean, there's just so many in this book that stand out. It was another kind of a swampy Bigfoot one, and this was almost like something out of a movie to me, like the scene. And this was another person that had seen something in a swampy area that was, you know, fit the description of a Bigfoot, a very credible witness, and one that I just sort of uncovered by doing some diligent research. But in this case, she was in a place called Chattawa Swamp, which is located in Mississippi, in the western portion of Mississippi, which is obviously a swampy area. And Chattawa Swamp is known for this creature called the Chattawa Swamp Monster. And it's something of a kind of a swampy Bigfoot. It's also an area where people have reported seeing wild monkeys and all sorts of other plethora of creatures that shouldn't be located in a swamp. But she said she was down there with her ex-husband in 1997. And their family had some property that backed up to that Chattawa Swamp. And they just went out there one evening just for relaxation. And they were sitting in the back of their truck, listening to music and stuff. And a thunderstorm rolled in, which is not uncommon down there on the Gulf Coast. They quickly roll in. And so rather than, you know, try to drive out of there, they just decided to wait it out, got in their truck, you know, got in the cab and jammed on the music and stuff and waited there for a while till it passed. Well, you know, once the major wave of the storm had passed, they kind of got out and it looked like some more storms were going to come. So I thought, well, we better just make a, you know, drive out of here. But unfortunately the truck battery died because they had the radio and the lights on. And so they were debating, well, I guess we're going to have to walk this. And as they started walking down this old dirt road, there was lightning flashing in the sky. And when it did, it lit up, you know, the backdrop. And suddenly they looked and saw this silhouette of this huge man-like figure standing about 40 yards in front of them. And of course, at first they thought it was a person, which would be strange and scary enough, but it was just huge, and it just didn't look quite human from the shape of it. And as it sort of began to approach them, she said it was some kind of a thing, definitely not a man. And her ex-husband yelled, you know, this is private property. You need to get out of here. And that there was no response. This thing kind of kept coming towards them. And then it let out this horrible growl and a scream. And she said at that point, she just, you know, went into hysterics. And her husband actually had a gun in the truck, and he got that and decided to fire some shots towards the thing as a warning or whatever. And all the while, you know, the lightning's flashing and they could see its figure and the storm is brewing again. And then when he fired at it, the thing, whether it was hit or just from the noise, it ran into the woods and was breaking limbs and screaming and howling. And, you know, this was right in the path where they needed to go to get out of the area because the truck was dead. They had no choice. So they literally had to just run for it. And she said she could hear these screams echoing through the woods as they just took off running and ran, you know, ran for their lives, basically, into the stormy night, which was about 4 miles back to town.
Oh,
they ended up having to walk. She said she just will never forget that, you know, probably the scariest thing she'd ever seen in her life. And from then on out, you know, she never doubted that there was something to tales of the Chattawa Swamp Monster.
Now, did that change things? I mean, as far as they were going out there because they enjoyed it, you know, to hang out and play some music. And I mean, did that change their lives after that, as far as the kinds of things that they did when they weren't working or something?
Well, she, you know, she seemed fairly calm and composed about the story now, but yeah, I mean, she said for a long time, it just had spooked her so much that she just couldn't quite get it out of her mind. And she said, you know, just especially the howl of the angry howl or the whatever it was making, she can still hear that in her head. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, she just saying this was with her ex-husband. I don't know if that had anything to do with a parting of ways or anything. I'm not sure, but yeah, I found her to be a really good witness because it just, again, it was one of these where she, you know, last thing on her mind was a Bigfoot type creature. And then she just said, you know, that's what we saw. And it's, you know, stuck with me, sort of lingered in my head ever since then.
Sure would. So, Lyle, before I let you go, last question, I promise. What would your, if you could choose it, of course, which you can't, but what would your ideal Bigfoot sighting be? You know, how close would it be? Would you be on a canoe in the middle of the water? Would you be in your truck? Would you be out in the middle of a forest somewhere? Have you thought about that?
you know, sure. I mean, you kind of think about these things, you know, if you have an encounter, you know, what would it be? Because there's so many varieties of those, driving or so forth. But I think for me, you know, I would want to be present in the woods, on the ground, not in a car, you know, not in a canoe, somewhere where I could, you know, try to pursue the thing if it did take off and obviously look for prints or tracks or whatever. Which is, I guess, a little more dangerous because, you know, you would be on the, you know, level turf with the creature itself. But, you know, I think that's the thing. I don't know if I want to walk up on it too close. Maybe if I was, you know, in a tree stand or a hunter's blind or something, and I'm observing it, I would want to observe it for a long period of time. And there is stories, even in Sinister Swamps, where there's been some hunters that had the opportunity to observe them mm-hmm. from a distance. But, you know, I would say if it was within 30 or 40 yards and was just standing there and stood there for long enough for me to get a good description, you know, to take in all the details. And of course, if I could get a picture, obviously that would be ideal, but that seems to be easier said than done in most of these occurrences. But, you know, I would just go for it and say I'd like to see one pretty up close and in its terrain.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that, though, like you said, you'd have to be careful as far as how close you got, and the circumstances, of course, would have to be pretty well in your favor. Like, you don't want to come up on a mama and her baby. I think that from the stories that we've heard so far, that tends to really piss them off pretty bad. And then you don't want the alpha that stands between 8 and 10 feet to go, "You're in my house and now you're going to have a problem."
Absolutely. I mean, I have come up on bears a couple of times in the woods, and that's your first thing is you just hope that there's no cubs nearby or you've gotten between them, because those are the most dangerous circumstances. And certainly a creature like Bigfoot would be the same, being protective of its young. That is not a situation you would want.
No, no. It's okay if the young ones are like in the trees throwing their feces at you or something, and it's all fun and games, but you don't want to come up on them when they're in their quote-unquote safe zone. So, yeah, I just made up that poo-throwing thing. That's more of a gym thing. Sorry, everybody. I have to mention feces at least once an episode. So there you go, Lyle. You're welcome. Well, Lyle, let everybody know where to find you and, of course, all of your books.
Well, you can find out more information about me and my books at lyleblackburn.com. And that's got a link to my online store where if you would like autographed books and other things such as Small Town Monsters films that I've been involved in, you can order those there. And then, of course, my books are also available on Amazon in paperback and in some cases hardback, and both in Kindle and print versions. So go out there and check it out. If you've had a strange encounter, whether it's a swampy one or not, you can find contact information on my site at lyleblackburn.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Lyle. Is there anything that you wanted to tease as far as an upcoming book, or are you keeping that close to the chest?
Well, I've kind of dropped a hint. I do have another book coming out this year, which I rarely can get two out in a year, but this is another in the Boggy Creek subject, and it's more of a case book on all the sightings that have occurred over the years. Instead of a grand story, this is literally a collection of the encounters. So that should be out hopefully by mid-October, and give you something to read for the cozy winter.
Well, that's quite perfect and fitting. Well, let me know. I'll get you right back on. We can talk about that upcoming book. That's exciting. Well, Lyle, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Well, I'm so-and-so. I was given this name by my parents. I've been to such and such a college. I've done these things in my profession. I produce a little biography. The Buddha says, forget it. That's not true. That's some story. That's all gone. That's all past. I want to see the real you you are now. Well, nobody knows who that is, is it? Because we don't know ourselves except through listening to our echoes and consulting our memories. But then there's a real you, and that again leads us back to this question. Who are you? That is the real you. We shall see how they play with this exam. By the koans, to get you to come out of your shell and find out who you really are. quite divided on this. They will say, no, we don't believe literally in reincarnation. That after your funeral, you know, you will suddenly become somebody different, living somewhere else. They will say, reincarnation means this, that if you sitting here now are really convinced that you're the same person who walked in at the door half an hour ago, you're being reincarnated. If you are liberated, you understand that you're not. The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. There is only the present. That's the only real you that there is. The Zen master Dogen viewed it this way. He said, spring does not become the summer. First there is summer, and then there is spring.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.